This week, we explore the housing crisis in Guelph and Canada. It's clear we have a crisis in housing affordability. Several factors contribute to this crisis: stagnant wages, the transformation of housing into an investment, and outright financialization of housing through real estate investment trusts, also known as REITs. Our guests this week are Sean Campbell and Eric Small. Sean Campbell is the executive director of Union Co-op in Waterloo. Union Co-op was created to raise funds and purchase existing rental properties to permanently remove them from the real estate market. Eric Small works for the Guelph company, SHED, also known as SHED. SHED maintains a commitment to quality and community and focuses on the long-term impacts of home building on the local environment. Join us for a breezy breakfast, learn about REITs and the major part they play in the housing crisis. Listen to a discussion about unique solutions to the housing crisis. Find out why the county provides social housing in Guelph. Over to our moderator, Kevin Bowman.
All right, good morning and welcome everyone to this July 21st, 2022 edition of the Breezy Breakfast. Today's episode, the topic will be housing financialization and affordability. And we have a couple wonderful guests that are joining us. Just before I introduce those guests, I'm going to do a land acknowledgement. So we would like to acknowledge that within Guelph, we are currently occupying the ancestral lands of the Attawandran, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee peoples and the treaty lands and territories of the Mississaugas of the Credit. We recognize the significance of the Dish with One Spoon Covenant to this land and offer our respect and gratitude to all the Indigenous peoples of Turtle Island who have stewarded, loved, and defended this land for centuries. In stating this, we acknowledge that we are here as a result of historical and ongoing violence that has been done to Indigenous people and their lands through the process of colonization, which continues to be the lived experience of many Indigenous communities across Turtle Island to this day. So today we have two guests joining us. We have Sean Campbell, who is the executive director of Union Co-op, and also Eric Small, who is a construction manager at SHED, which is a design and build company here in Guelph. And as mentioned earlier, the topic for the day is housing financialization and affordability. So just to get us started, I'm gonna give us some definitions and what do we mean when we say financialization, the financialization of housing. So financialization is a term used in the sphere of economics. It's usually used speaking about entire economies. And basically what it means is if an economy is being financialized, that means there's an increase in the size and importance of finance and investment activity relative to the sort of traditional activities of an economy, you know, the production of goods and services. So if more, a bigger percentage of your economy is dedicated towards finance and investment versus production of goods and services, then you are a financialized economy. Some of the results of this, according to the best studies we have access to, is that financialized economies tend to have more of a bubble and bust cycle. Wage stagnation is a problem, increasing wealth inequality and income inequality is a problem. It often leads to regulatory capture, which is something we can define a little bit later, deregulation and increased political influence and control by the folks that are doing the financialization, the wealthy. So when we speak about housing financialization, it's essentially the same process, but specifically within the housing sector. So there's an increase in the size and importance of finance and investment relative to the construction, management, and maintenance of housing. This tends to result in inflated housing prices, inflated rents, et cetera. It also results in an extraction of money from the housing sector to pay for the investors' returns instead of using that money to actually build and maintain housing. One concrete example of this would be what's called a real estate investment trust, which exists in Canada. They've only existed since 1993. So this is a relatively recent financial structure that has come into existence. And a real estate investment trust owns income-producing properties for investors, And the tax laws in Canada currently mean that they pay a lot less taxes compared to other forms of income, whether that's salaried income or capital gains. In fact, a real estate investment trust can pay no tax at all if they distribute all of their after tax income, or after expenses income to their shareholders. So if they're acting as just a clearinghouse for the rents coming in and then redistributing that to the investors, then there's no tax paid on that investment income whatsoever. Now, Sean Campbell from Union Co-op, who's joining us, is the executive director of Union Co-op. And can you tell us a little bit about Union Co-op, what they're doing and how that relates to some of the things I just defined?
Yeah, thanks so much, Kevin, and for organizing this great event as well. So Union Co-op is a new organization out of Waterloo Region, and we think we're actually the first of our kind in Canada of merging together the community land trust model and renewable energy co-op. So I'll talk a bit about both, but a community land trust is typically defined as a nonprofit that is attempting to acquire land and bring it out of the market to hold on to it permanently for affordability. But they often really struggle to find the resources needed to buy land. At the same time, we have renewable energy co-ops like the Community Energy Development Cooperative here in Waterloo Region in Guelph, or the Toronto Renewable Energy Co-op, that have raised tens of millions of dollars through the co-op model for solar and wind. We haven't yet seen that applied to affordable housing. So with Union Co-op, our mission is to acquire existing residential and commercial properties and hold on to them for permanent affordability through community ownership. And we do that by raising funds from community members just like us through small investments, pool those funds together, which forms the down payment required to buy properties. And then the remainder of the funds can come from charitable foundations or from banks. So we're getting ready to buy our very first property, which has 58 newly renovated two-bedroom units in Kitchener. The average rents are $1,275, whereas the cost to rent a vacant two-bedroom unit in Waterloo Region has now passed $2,000 a month. So what we're seeing here is, you know, these older types of apartments are often referred to as naturally occurring affordable housing units, where they were never built to be affordable housing. They didn't get government funding to create them, but they have really long-term tenants. And it's, you know, long-term tenants, they don't have granite top or stainless steel appliances, but they've been home for folks for a long time. And because of provincial rent controls, that means that they're typically more affordable than the market. These are the properties that are targeted by real estate investment trusts, private equity, and big businesses as well, because of the potential for revenue enhancement strategies to make more money through rental uplift, which really means waiting out the existing tenants and increasing the rent, or encouraging tenants to leave early through a variety of tactics. That can be really profitable. But the challenge for the housing system is it then creates a lot of downward pressure on the social housing system. If folks can't find these low-cost apartments, then ultimately they're stuck trying to find spots through government and charitable organizations. So we're trying to fit in that middle point with our regional government and charities and nonprofits doing really great, really important work to build new, deeply affordable units. And the private sector providing a lot of apartments at market rents, but we have that missing gap there. And that's where we're trying to fit in for folks earning between minimum wage and about $20 an hour, or seniors on fixed income, still, you know, able to live independently, but just really struggling to find a spot that's affordable. And our theory here is if as a community we come together, we can pull these markets out, or pull these properties out of the market and hold on to them for permanent affordability through community ownership.
Awesome. Thank you so much for filling us in on Union Co-op and what they're doing. I just want to say personally that I think what you're doing is awesome, because yeah, that gap between sort of the rent geared to income approach and the private developers making a whole lot of market rate stuff, you're totally right. There's a giant gap in between there. And yeah, nobody seems to be active there, certainly not in the private sector, because there's not a lot of profit to be made. And yeah, I think it's great that we're getting some of these properties off the market, because as you say, they're being targeted purposely by these for-profit investment firms. And so we need to protect them and maintain them.
Yeah, thanks so much. And certainly it takes some creativity to do that, because the margins are really tight. These for-profit companies will bid on a property knowing that they can increase the rents. So that's part of their asking price. So we need to get really creative with different strategies in order to contain costs or partner with the municipality for things like property tax reductions or HST reductions through the federal government in order to make this efficient and affordable.
Yeah, for sure. Could you perhaps expand on that a little bit? Like how, if you were hypothetically to get into a situation where you were literally in a bidding war with one of these private equity firms, how would you hope to navigate that?
So we know that one of the other bidders on this 58 unit property was a small REIT based in Ontario. And we simply came in with a better purchase price. You know, for us, we have a few ways that allow us to do that. We have concessionary investments. So we have community members like us who are willing to accept lower returns because they know that they're doing something positive for our community. We also have charitable foundations that are providing loans at below market rates as well. So we're bringing down the size of the bank mortgage through charitable foundation investments, and we're able to defer some of that repayment as well. So with the charitable foundations, we pay principal and interest at maturity as opposed to ongoing cash flow requirements. And there's some opportunities that are emerging for either reducing our property taxes or bringing them all the way down to zero for a few years as well to help us catch back up. There's a similar possibility of allowing us to reclaim HST, which typically housing organizations can't do. So there are a few pieces out there. You know, there's a lot of disjointed things in the housing sector. And part of the fun and the challenge of doing this work is finding a model that, you know, brings this all together, takes more work on this first property. And then the hope and the goal is that we're able to come up with a bit of a program here that we can move forward with, but also, you know, to share with communities like Guelph and London who want to replicate this work in their own unique way to make it that much easier to keep this going.
Excellent. And you mentioned that there was some coordination or partnership with the region. Can you speak a little bit to what that looks like? And if there's any support being offered by the provincial or federal governments or their agencies, could you speak to that as well?
So we've been really fortunate to have received some grant support from the National Housing Strategy delivered by CMHC. That grant support was just for the development of the model. And there's no ongoing grant support, whether that, you know, subsidies for rent or for our time. And nothing towards the purchase of the property. So we've not received any ongoing or capital support from any level of government. We are speaking with our municipalities about the possibility of a property tax reduction, but that's the extent of it. You know, one of the challenges is that these older types of apartment buildings pay twice the property tax of a newer apartment building, even though newer apartment buildings have typically significantly higher rents. There's some good reason for that. It was an incentive created in the early 2000s to try and create more apartments, but it's having the impact of not necessarily encouraging affordable rents, but just, you know, these newer units get cheaper property tax. So as of right now, there's no government support for our work. But certainly lots of interest, and we're having conversations and hoping that, you know, through this work, we can make it easier for ourselves in the future, but also other communities as well who want to do similar work.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Just before we continue, there's another term I want to introduce and define. And I'd actually be curious to know both from Sean and Eric if they've heard this term before, and we'll get to that in a moment. So there's a term in the economic sphere called rent seeking, and it's not what it appears to be at first, because when this term is not referring to rent as in like from a lease, it's more the case of seeking particular type of income. So if you go to some of the most classical texts in economics, like your Adam Smith's and Ricardo's and stuff like that, they put all types of income that a person could generate into one of a couple different buckets. There was wage income, so you're getting paid by an employer for the work you do. There was trade income, so you're providing a product or a service to people and they pay you for that. And then there was rent, which is, as you would traditionally think of it, like, well, you own something and you're allowing somebody else use of it, but it could also mean other things. And one of the classical examples in textbooks and such of rent-seeking behavior would be, suppose you had a landowner that has a river that goes through their property, and this river is public and people go fishing there. The landowner decides to put up a chain blocking the river and charge a toll for you to get past the chain to go fishing in the river. This is rent-seeking because the chain being there and the landlord operating the chain does not actually add any kind of value or benefit to the community. It just makes something that used to be free cost money. So you're putting an artificial barrier or an extra step into what otherwise would be a simple process, and then charging money for people to get through that step or barrier. And so that's what rent seeking is. And generally speaking, in the economic sphere, rent seeking is seen as a negative. It's a bad thing that governments and communities should be trying to avoid, because it encourages bad behavior and tends to insert extra processes and bureaucracy and make things more expensive than they need to be. And anyway, the reason I bring this up is because, in my personal opinion, and I could be wrong because I'm not an economist, a lot of the behavior of, say, real estate investment trusts, I think is rent seeking. They're inserting themselves into a transaction where they're not necessary, and they're extracting money for their investors. So instead of having the people who live in a building just pay money to own the building eventually through the process of a mortgage, now they're paying rents to this investment body, which holds the mortgage and also is extracting profits for their investors. So yeah, I'd just be curious to know that. Sean, do you think I'm way off base on this, or is that like somewhat accurate description of what's happening?
Yeah, I think absolutely that is the goal of these organizations, is to earn income off renting, and there needs to be that gap between their costs and what they need to pay out a return, whatever rate they set as their target return. I think there are certain costs as well. So even a charity or a nonprofit may pay a mortgage cost, and that bank also has investors as well. So there are certain types of things built into this system. But I think really a big question that you raised, Kevin, is about, what is your priority? What is your goal? Is your goal that you are maximizing returns? Is that continuous where you're always doing that? We look at the community land trust movement, and I think it's more of a movement than a model, at least in its origin, as it comes out of the African American liberation movement of in the US in the 1970s, of people trying to move away from rent seeking that was tied to slavery and Reconstruction challenges as well. Challenges is a wholly inaccurate or inaccurate word or inadequate word to describe that. And that's really where this movement started, was how do we bring the land into community ownership And they learned a lot from other land movements around the world, including down in Mexico and Gandhi's land movement and in Israel as well, to say, you know, we need to separate land and the value that that holds to a community from buildings. So a traditional community land trust will own the land, and then they rent out the right to build a building on top of it. You can then sell the building down the road, but the community still always owns the land. There's some, you know, older economists who pushed that idea as well, that this was not something, land wasn't something you created through your labor. So it's not something that you should be able to own directly. I think the piece as we go forward here is to think about, you know, what are restrictions that could be placed on rents? What are ways that we could think about rents differently as opposed to just having it be about extraction? And nonprofit housing co-ops certainly are one avenue for that, where the tenants set their own rent each year. And they do it based on how much they need to bring in order to pay their mortgage, just still going to those outside investors, but, you know, at least is a little contained, and to pay for the repairs of the property as well. Now, unfortunately, in Waterloo region, where I'm from, we've not had a new nonprofit housing co-op since the Ray days of the early 1990s. And our community looks a heck of a lot different now than it did back then. So, you know, we need to think about, in lieu of significant government investment in this type of work, you know, what are other sources of funds, other ways that community can intervene? And that's always been part of the co-op ethos, is to act autonomously and independently when there's a market failure of some form or a government failure, to look at, you know, how do we step forward, still make sure that we're having the impact in lieu of something more significant.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad you brought up that gap since the last time there was any significant construction or funding for nonprofit housing co-ops. Because you mentioned market failure, because that's really important too. Because I think it's really important for folks to realize that our provincial and federal governments used to know that the private market was not going to provide enough affordable housing, and so they had a ton of money and programs and government agencies to deal with that. Like the CMHC used to hand out very generous mortgage supports and insurance for developers that wanted to build nonprofit housing co-ops. But then they stopped doing that roughly around the 90s, as you mentioned. And yeah, nothing like that has been really built since then province-wide. And
Now there are still some really great CMHC programs, and we're applying to one to support this first purchase. And, you know, I think there are some really hard, especially at municipal level, some really hardworking government staff doing their best to support where they can, but with a lot more limited resources than what were available a generation ago, not even a generation ago. So, yeah, I think there's different pieces here, but, you know, some of the broader economic aspects, we have people who can't move now. So we think about unemployment or having a well-functioning economy. You also have people who are staying in apartments that may be, you know, not adequately sized if they have a growing family, or where they may not be able to access the employment that they need, or where the landlord may not be great, or their neighbors may not be great, but they need to stay there. We have situations where an individual is looking to leave a bad domestic situation, whether that involves intimate partner violence or just a relationship breaking up. Where do they go? You know, you can go from a low discounted rent that you've been in for years, all of a sudden on your own, having to be able to afford a really significant increase. So when we think about the role of the private sector here as well, you know, there are potentially lots of great opportunities, you know, through increasing supply through urban intensification, which also can bring down some prices in a certain way. And if we're increasing the supply of these non-market rentals as well, that can also support bringing down rental rates as well. You know, it creates a bit of that that cap, a little bit like unionization of the workforce, where even non-union shops start to incorporate some of the HR policies or benefits of unionized labor because there's that competitive alternative. If we increase the competitive alternative, then, you know, maybe the private sector starts looking a little more affordable because there's not such a low vacancy rate that it allows for such a high increase of rents.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I don't know about you, but I have some suspicions about the vacancy rate. There was an article recently in one of the papers, I forget which one, but there was a study done by Bank of Montreal, and it seems like they were doing some myth busting about the housing supply. Because we're always told, oh, there's not enough supply. There's not enough supply. That's why the prices are so high and we need to build, build, build. And I don't think that's completely untrue, but I think it's exaggerated because there seems to be a lot of evidence that there's a lot of properties that are empty or are not being used for housing when they could be used for housing. One of the things we did in preparation for this show is we provided the potential attendees with a link to a documentary called Push, which was featuring and following Leilani Farha, who's a Toronto lawyer and was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on housing, the right to housing. She was traveling around Canada, but also other countries looking at why is housing becoming so unaffordable. And one of the things she discovered in London and New York, and I suspect this is true in Toronto as well, where there's significant chunks of the housing stock that are owned by investors and there's nobody living in them. The investors are just sitting on it as a speculative investment. London, they actually got some concrete numbers. They showed a map of downtown London and there's red dots all over it. Each dot was a property owned by an investor. And then they surveyed those properties and found that 80% of them were vacant. There's nobody in them. Mm. And they actually visited some of these places and it's like, yeah, here's a street that's like a row of townhouses and there's nobody in them. It's completely vacant. It's just a dead community.
I'm certainly not an expert on this stuff and likely, you know, you and others on this call know a lot more. I did look at the Region of Waterloo's recent housing report and they considered a vacancy tax, which now municipalities in Ontario have the authority to do. And they noted two things. One is, they don't have a lot of great data to know whether or not there are vacant units. So that maybe is something at the provincial or federal level that there needs to be new or different tools. But based on the data they do have, they didn't find significant vacant units in Waterloo region. And I think we're not London or Toronto. Vancouver did impose a vacancy tax and they have seen vacant units decrease as a result of that. So it does show that, you know, government and taxes can have a shaping impact on the market there as well. But I would suspect that, you know, for communities like Kitchener and Guelph, you know, one of the biggest vacancies we have that isn't often discussed is are all the vacant rooms inside of single family homes. And this also connects back to housing affordability as well. We have boomers who are aging in place in their homes, which is fantastic, but maybe are considering downsizing. You know, you don't want to take care of the big yard anymore, work on the roof, do all that stuff, but you can't find anywhere affordable to live. You know, you can't find an apartment. So it's actually cheaper to stay, pay your mortgage, or your mortgage has been paid off. Your financial advisor is saying, don't sell. Even with the amount of money that you'd make on your house, you know, it's still a losing proposition. So we have these 2, 4, 5 unit or 5 bedroom houses with 1 or 2 people living in it. You know, one of the ways that we could look at increasing the supply of single family homes is to create better spots for seniors to retire in a way that they know that they won't be evicted down the road to increase someone's profits, that the rents will be reasonable and respectful, and maybe also have different amenities that that make them feel like, you know, it's still a home. That could be another way of thinking about these vacant units, or of course, work that I think Eric and similar organizations do of building laneway suites or granny suites, garden suites, of turning homes into duplexes as a way of increasing supply as well. We can gently increase the density within some of these existing subdivisions.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a great segue. Thank you very much, because you're totally right that, Guelph and Kitchener-Waterloo are not London or New York. So I don't think we have the same scale of problem as they do with investors buying property and then just sitting on it. Yeah, you're right. There's definitely some opportunity, I think, in folks that empty nesters, you know, parents that are occupying a four-bedroom home because they had kids, but now the kids have moved on. And now they're in that house and they're staying there because it makes financial sense. But that housing's being underused, so to speak, because it's got a bunch of bedrooms in it that aren't being filled by people that need bedrooms. And as you mentioned, one of the options to address that would be to set up incentives or encourage folks to build accessory dwelling units or laneway houses or renovate their homes so that it's got multiple units within it. And as you mentioned, our other guest, Eric Small from Shed, that's kind of their business. So Eric, I'd like to bring you in and maybe you can tell us a little bit more about Shed and accessory dwelling units and where are we at with that right now? What are the barriers that companies like yourself face to really expanding your operation and building out more accessory dwelling units and renovating existing houses so that we're making better use of our housing stock?
Yeah, thank you for the introduction. And again, thank you for the invite to be here. Sean and Kevin, been great to listen to you guys talk and learn about this idea of financialization. I've read a little bit about it, but this has been very informative. So thank you. I can speak to trying to kind of connect all of it and be able to speak to what you're talking about. But I think some of the barriers right now, aside from sometimes financial barriers, I think it's the mechanisms that, or the lack of mechanisms that are in place from a zoning, legal and planning end that get in the way. I mean, Guelph is getting better, followed Kitchener-Waterloo in terms of allowing the zoning changing to have a separate ADU on a property. And the big thing was that it can share the services of the existing house. So for instance, you're not having to do a separate sewer, water, and hydro connection. So that was a big shift that certainly has helped a lot. So it does feel like things are moving in the right direction. At Shed, what we're really doing, and my business partner wasn't able to be here today, Gavin Baxter, he does all of our planning, design. He's a technologist with a postgrad in systems design. Systems meaning, more of the kind of social economic systems, and taking that and applying it to housing. So a big thing that we are doing with people is scenario planning and looking at the existing house and, creating a scenario for the next 5 years. What are the immediate needs of that family in the near future, and then looking at it in 10 years and saying, okay, so how from year 5 to year 10, what could shift? Kids are now in university because of the affordability. Are they living at home still, or are they moving? You project even past that, you go kind of to the 10 to 15 year, 10 to 20, maybe these kids are coming back with their own families. Again, because of everything you've been talking about, younger generation getting into not even necessarily the housing market, but just getting into having a place to live, is decreasing significantly. So how can we look at a project and try and plan for some of that, so that spaces can be flexible, spaces can shift, and really questioning and trying to encourage people to have some curiosity around how much space do you actually need. I mean, I don't have the figures in front of me right now, but a new, say, 2,500 square foot home is kind of designed for, you know, a family of 2 to 3. And when you break it down to square foot space per person, it's a lot. And so, you know, we're challenging people to look at, you know, there's a difference between the personal and private square footage that people require versus the public or amenity space that can be shared. So, I mean, in a nutshell, that's a lot of what we do when we're in the preliminary stages of planning with people. I think what we hit a lot also is the idea of aging in place and how, because I forget if it was Sean or Kevin who touched on it, creating spaces for the aging population to remain in their communities and neighborhoods. I mean, there's lots of incentives from the government, and there will likely continue to be building LTCs out in cornfields. And I mean, it does serve a purpose, but you're taking people from their community, and we're saying, well, we're going to stick you over here. And I think there's many avenues you could go down when talking about that subject. I think for us, it's the idea of how can a space shift and allow seniors to remain in their community and age gracefully. So we have had the opportunity to do a couple of those projects, and they're meaningful. It feels, you know, you really get to know the family, you get to know the story, you get to know the situation, and it's not just an addition or a renovation. It's something more than that, and it's feels really nice to be a part of it.
One quick follow-up I have, and then we'll get to some audience questions for both you and Sean. That's great. As you mentioned, that Guelph is moving in the right direction in terms of, you know, lifting some of those bylaw barriers for making better use of our existing housing by modifying it. In your opinion, as somebody who's working in this area, what do you think the next steps are? What are the next barriers that we should be tackling or trying to make less of a impediment to, you know, turning some of our existing housing stock into more units and make better use of that housing stock, get more people in them?
So yeah, a great question. I'm not as well versed in it as my business partner is, but I know that out west, I believe it's called a strata, where you can have a shared ownership of a property. So instead of the idea of, you know, building an ADU or you know, renting a room or a portion of the house out, that you can actually have two people that, you know, that own that property collectively. And so it's not necessary, there isn't one person who's collecting rent and profiting from it. It's more of a a shared ownership model, almost like a condo, but on a very small scale. I think that's a big one. And I mean, we are seeing more of that from the idea of co-housing. So I've been lucky to be involved in a project in Guelph. It's called the Watershed Co-Housing Development. And it's a 5-unit, 3-story building that we're doing. And it's actually an addition to an existing building. The architect, developer, and owner is David McCauley. He's been working on this now for about 10 years. Lots of hurdles from the city, which I won't get into, but the model, as I understand it, is he's essentially created a numbered company that not only owns the existing building, but that owns the addition, new build on the back of it, and opened it up to people to basically purchase shares within that numbered company that would get them a unit. And what it's done in this particular case is it's allowed a lot of like-minded people to have the opportunity to have a space in a very well-designed, energy efficient building. So we're not seeking passive house certification, but we are building to a passive house standard, which is fantastic, but it's not that type of building is not accessible to everyone just from a financial standpoint. So this idea of co-housing, where you've got people living together in community, it's, you know, the economies of scale are allowing it to be more accessible. So I mean, that's maybe a bit of a long rambling answer to your question. But in a nutshell, this idea of shared ownership, I think needs to happen. And I think we're going to see more of it, because the idea of, people owning their own property and, you know, like just two individuals in a single family dwelling of 2,500 square feet. I think it's going to become unaffordable, and there's going to need to be more options available just from an economic standpoint. From an environmental standpoint, I mean, the greenest house is the one that already exists. Renovating and maintaining existing building stock is the best thing. I mean, you can build great new energy efficient buildings, but however you build it, there's a lot of carbon implications. And so the idea of maintaining and reimagining our existing building stock is from an environmental standpoint is a good way to go.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's, as you say, it's great that Guelph is moving in the right direction in terms of updating the zoning to make some of these options of renovating and repurposing existing building stock a little bit easier. Hopefully we continue down that path, and the quicker the better. Because I agree with you. There's always going to be, a significant portion of the population that wants that single family detached home. But we've kind of structured our zoning bylaws and mortgage agreements and finance arrangements and legal arrangements in such a way that that's kind of the only option. Like, if you want to do anything other than that, it's really difficult. If you walk into a bank and say, I want to do co-housing, they kind of look at you like you have three heads, because they don't understand how that works, because nobody does it. We really need to drastically increase some the education and capacity for our institutions, their municipal governments, our banks, and to accommodate those kinds of things, because yeah, we're going to need that flexibility in the coming years, I think. Well, we probably needed it a decade ago. We're behind the ball, but yeah, we'll get there. Yeah. Really helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. All right. Well, I know we've had some questions coming in through the chat as we've been going. So I'm going to ask Tanya to maybe go through there and pose some of those questions, and we'll get you guys to chime in on that.
Okay, sure. The fear of land trusts is, can they truly be trusted? How can it be assured that those in the role of trustees secure the housing and the land for future? How do funds get accumulated for capital improvements on a property, like a co-op in a land trust?
Yeah, that's a big and tricky question. So the short answer is there aren't legal requirements that a land trust stay a land trust. There is no legal entity called a community land trust. Instead, it is incorporated as a nonprofit. A charity is protected by the CRA. You know, it was the tax man that took down Capone. And similarly, the CRA will not allow charitable assets to leave the charitable environment. But because of charity rules, CLTs, community land trusts, generally are not charities. You know, it's not a charitable purpose to prevent someone from falling into poverty. You can only help someone once they're sufficiently poor. So with a nonprofit community land trust, what you can do is create what's called an asset lock. So in your articles of incorporation and bylaws, you create certain rules, and they can be almost identical to what a charity has to follow. Of if we ever shut down, everything has to be donated to a registered charity. Now that is not ironclad. Those things can be changed. But there are other things you can do as well. So what a community land trust does is they have three classes of membership. All members, all classes have to agree to sell the assets of the land trust or to close up. So their membership types are the tenants, community members, just like us. And normally they'll have like institutional members. So maybe the Guelph Community Foundation, the city of Guelph. So, you know, maybe there's a situation where all three membership groups decide the CLT no longer has a purpose. We should actually close up. You know, due to climate change and sinkholes, the buildings have all fallen into the ground. There's nothing to rent anymore. Let's close up shop. Or instead, one of the groups tries to sell and the other two groups say, no, that's not in our interest. We're not going to do that. Certainly there could be other protections. So if you have an agreement with CMHC, CMHC will say for 20 years or however many amount of years, you have to maintain a certain level of affordability. And the if not, you're in default on your mortgage with CMHC. They can take over your building. They can force you to do what changes that they want to do. So there are these different protections. It should be easier. It should be simpler. But, you know, these are folks who are working really hard to try and build affordable units. And I think, you know, at a certain degree, trust is required, but then also looking at how do we layer these different types of enforcements and learn from what's been experimented with by community land trusts across Canada, across the US for decades in order to build affordability. So that's the starting point in terms of capital improvements. You know, a bank and CMHC will require that a certain amount is set aside. Historically, there hasn't been enough set aside. The requirements have been too low, but that's something that you can do as well. You can set that at 2 or 4% of all of your revenues go towards a capital improvement reserve, as well as having sufficient in your expenses as well. So, you know, all of this comes down to good planning. And that is something where folks like Eric with that expertise, or also big developers as well, and existing housing charities can provide that experience as well. You know, what would they do on a building like that? And I think there are a lot of folks in the sector, including, you know, profit maximizing developers who do care about this to varying degrees. Not everybody, but folks that you can learn from and say, you know, what would you do in terms of setting that capital reserve. There are some funding sources out there as well through the Center for Housing Transformation and CMHC to fund capital planning studies as well. And that's also important. So this work is hard. It shouldn't be as hard as it is, but it is hard. But fortunately, there's lots of good people in government, at charitable foundations, and in the private sector, all working really hard to make this a better, easier process.
For rent-controlled units, how likely can we get government to stop allowing unlimited rental increase once a unit has been vacated?
So I'll just say that currently there are no restrictions on what you set your rents to when somebody vacates a unit, which is one of the important reasons why we need to bring existing affordably rented apartments into community ownership. And how to make that happen, you know, from my perspective, is either bring buildings into community ownership, or folks like all of you on the call here today, we all need to organize together in order to advocate for certain types of expanded rent controls. Also, newer apartment buildings don't have any rent controls. Only older apartment buildings have rent control. So we need to think about this from a few angles. There's the kind of applied community work that Eric and I do. Let's try and buy units or build units. That's important. But also then there's the political piece that all of us as community members can engage in of, you know, this is not something that necessarily politicians think about every day. There's lots of things they have to think about. What are ways that we can organize to make sure this becomes front and center, bringing together different coalitions of people to try and get some policy change?
Phil, do you want to take a shot at that?
Sure, Tanya, I will. I apologize, there's a bit of noise here, so I hope you can hear me. The rent controls issue has a very simple answer, and that is legislation. Rent controls were changed as a consequence of legislation, and no government has had the courage in the last probably 15 years to address this. There are other factors as well, and one issue that's fairly important is the actual cost involved in flipping a house. So if a house is actually a rental property and it's flipped right now in a period of inflationary housing costs, then landlords are inclined, I think in some ways, rightly so, to recoup their costs through the rental. And so we need to examine how we limit the sale of houses, and I'm not opposed to selling houses, but I am opposed to offshore sales, and also the pressure that is put on housing. We need to be mindful. This is a consequence of governments getting out of social housing during the Mulroney years. If that had not happened, we would not have the upward pressure that we're experiencing now, which has led to housing. Now, I believe, when I last thought about it, for a person owning or earning an average wage, they are expected to pay for an average mortgage, about 50% of their income on that. Whereas the formula 40 years ago was 25%. That's a massive increase and it's a significant problem. So the answer lies in legislation. And again, as I said, it's multifactorial. So if anybody wants to bring a petition to city council and speak on it, I'd be very happy. I think city council should take it to the Association of Municipalities of Ontario and push the government on rent controls. Rent's out of control. It's just that simple.
Maybe if we had a mayor that was very passionate about this, we would have better luck with regards to making changes about rent controls.
Well, the mayor is a passionate guy, and I don't think it would hurt for people to approach him on this. There are many ways that we can address housing, underhousing, and poverty and disparity within this community. The community probably knows better than either I or the mayor on what the issues are, and perhaps we need to have community engagement on this issue. I mean, I in some senses, just a tangent, I look forward to the strong mayor system because a strong mayor then is responsible for issues like this, and that will be a challenge for mayors, and they then become answerable, and I think that's a good thing.
Scott had a question. or more of a comment, the city of Guelph needs to build and renovate housing, not Wellington County.
The County of Wellington has been assigned as our agent for housing and social services. Now I see the councillor, former councillor Carl Wettstein is here. Councillor Wettstein was quite adamant that in fact the city was not getting the best bang for the buck. And about 8 years ago, he and others attempted to change this relationship. But the courts determined that the county will continue to be our agent and that the city must continue to pay its share. So we spend far beyond $15 million a year. We are required to spend $15 million, plus we provide money for daycare and other supports. So our share of the costs for affordable housing right now is 8.1% of our annual budget. We give the money, but many people are quite correct. We don't seem to get the bang for the buck. And in defense of the county, Carl might not like this, the county is also looking to get its bang for the buck. They can put far more resources into housing outside of the city than we can put into housing inside the city simply because of the cost of land. And that's something to consider. And Carl, I think, would be really, probably if he's willing to do it, a good person to hear from on this. Carl, do you want to talk on this or not?
Well, I've just been trapped by my friend Phil. I agree with most of what he said. The only subtle thing I change, it's not so much that the county is a problem for us. It's his point that the cheap land is all in the county. So if we're getting a bang for our buck in which the province has determined one or the other has to look after that one, they look after affordable housing, we look after the emergency operation for them. So that was something the province did many, many years ago. My concerns and many other councillors at that time was more the relationship where that control was disproportionate. They felt we had disproportionate control with emergency services and we felt they had. So we would battle at the governance level of how many seats we had and who had voted and which councillors could interfere with it. So that thing is a problem with getting at what's necessary now that this particular topic is dealing with. Affordable housing has no boundaries. And I think the boundary part of the current municipal act, where we've got our structure between us and the county, is probably part of that problem. That can be solved if we can get our act together in some other areas.
The issue is around the relationship between the county and the city, and should the city not take it back? I mean, I believe we should, but we are actually restricted from doing that. The county is our provider by legislation.
Yeah, and that's because of the model we fit in where we are. We have to work jointly, and in a lot of other cases, the major cities, and we weren't one, were separate entities. I think that's absolutely right. When it comes to this topic, that issue is critical. That committee is probably one of the most important committees when it comes to the affordable housing element and the social housing element of society. And that's where I know Phil's referred to the old co-op housing model. And just a brief comment on history. I worked with the cooperators for 30 plus years. We were intricately involved in the development and financing of that product. And as a company, which was the largest cooperative in the country, the largest insurance co-op for sure, we were really disappointed when that element of community involvement was weakened substantially, and no government has picked it up afterwards. There have been different governments in power. Sure, I blame Mulroney a little bit. Phil and I are not quite on the same plane there. But at the end of the day, no government has had the willingness or the ability to pick up that ball. Your speakers today are touching on that, and I think they're touching on it in a really, really out-of-the-box way. And that is the principle of co-op, which does apply, is that your membership in the co-op dictates your ownership of whatever the service you have. And that applies to housing as well. And it doesn't matter whether you've got a 100-unit condo or a 3-unit shared single-family residence. That principle can help to bring way more utilization. I'm guilty. I'm living in a 2,000 square foot house with my wife because my kids are all gone. So you've now made me feel that I need to find a way to bring a renter in here.
Let me just follow up on that, because I think that there is something that is important for Eric and other builders to take advantage of, and that is the city's change to inclusive zoning. That is in some ways radical. And it does provide for us to actually take advantage of Carl's offer to subdivide his house and for us to actually put in units in areas that have been traditionally identified as areas that will only be single family dwellings, and put in what we understand, but which is slightly wrong, accessory units. We're talking about, with inclusive zoning, we're talking about semi-detached and triplexes sitting beside 2,000, 3,000 square foot single family dwellings. It's radical, and I'm quite supportive. I also will say that I think some on council haven't quite understood that this is what this means. It will change the configuration of the city somewhat, and I think that's a good thing. We don't need to ghettoize ourselves so that we live in single family areas and apartment areas and condo areas and so on and so forth. We can develop and we can design effectively without those kinds of restrictions if we put our minds to it. And the planners are quite enthusiastic about this. This is cutting red tape in a good way.
Okay, excellent. I have another question. It's actually from Morgan has a question. What kind of impact do you think having more purpose-built, higher-end student rental buildings will have on the number of detached homes acting as student housing? Are these types of houses a good opportunity for an organization like yours to bring into a co-op?
Yeah, so unfortunately, single family homes are really tough to make the math work for. The prices have just gone through the roof, as we all know. So the ability for us to buy a single family home at, you know, $800,000 or $1 million, divide that into two units, then all of a sudden you have, you know, $500,000 a unit. These larger, older properties. So if you drive around Guelph now, start looking for, especially within older neighborhoods, you'll see single family homes. And then all of a sudden you'll see 8, 10, 12, 20 units on 2 to 3 family lots. And on a per unit basis, those cost about $200,000 to $250,000 a unit. So significantly cheaper than a single family home. And that's where we're putting more of our attention of saving these older apartment buildings. But for a team like Eric's, you know, that could be really great if the current owner says, well, you know, the students are moving out into these newer apartment buildings. So it's no longer the right market. Maybe I'm going to convert this into a duplex or a triplex, and I want someone who does awesome work like Eric to come in and make that sustainable.
Phil.
Hey, I want to take that on from the city perspective. I actually am opposed to that kind of student housing to which Morgan refers. And I'm opposed to it for a number of reasons. If you've noticed, the student housing that is being built by the private sector is characterized as luxury student housing. Now, I'm going to get a bit folksy here. But I would expect that anybody here who went to university probably spent a little bit of time in a basement or an attic or in housing that would not be characterized as luxury. And I think we've done okay. And I'm not denigrating that at all, by the way. But for those developers to characterize that housing as luxury means a couple of things. First of all, it's going to be expensive. Secondly, it does not, to my understanding, fall under the current restrictions on rent increases and rent controls, because it is, for all intents and purposes, supportive housing, similar to any other supportive housing within the community. And to me, that's a problem. If we want to put supportive housing in, let's put it in for those people who are underhoused, can't find housing, or are homeless. The problem with this also is that if the private sector develops multiple luxury student housing, such as what we see on Stone Road, the responsibility for supervision and policing falls to the city, not the university. And that's an issue. They are residents of the city. They are outside of the university's control. And many people have commented on the big parties that have occurred at St. Patrick's Day and Homecoming. The university, quite rightly, washes their hands of that. It's not their responsibility. But quite wrongly, they don't wash their hands of it because they have permitted this and encouraged this. But that's also a provincial government issue because they don't want to build student housing on university campuses. I'd like to see a return to that. The other thing to remember, every time we build that kind of housing, we are actually replacing what could be put on there with housing for students. And that's a significant pressure on the whole housing portfolio. I have to say I'm completely opposed to it.
Yeah, I think it's really dangerous to take the student housing issue and try to integrate it into that. To me, all student housing, whatever the design is, and I was in the development business, is simply a developer finding a new way to raise rents. So I think student housing is a separate issue. It doesn't deal with the problem we're dealing with. As Phil's already pointed out, they're pinpointing the rich students in the development of their product. I think that we are talking about something that we should totally stay away from. My definition of that condo and or duplex is that's not for students. That's not the purpose. The purpose of that type of flexibility and that type of creativity is to meet the need of the non-student. The student, to me, shouldn't even be part of this discussion.
Thanks, Carl. Tanya, I'm going to have to get going right now. I have to return a nail gun that I borrowed from somebody who's actually doing some building in Kitchener and needs that back. So I'm going to go. Thanks to Eric and Sean for speaking on these issues. The future is now, and housing is not going to look the same in 20, 30 years. Appreciate you both being on the ground on the transformations that we need to keep people not just adequately housed, but better housed. Take care to everyone.
Thanks, Phil. It was nice meeting you.
Tanya, it's Linda. I'm on my phone because I'm computerless. Can I just get in the queue for a question? Thank you for organizing this. And Sean, hi, it's Linda, the West Village Community Development Cooperative. My question is about the size of housing. And part of the reason in West Guelph, we really want to have a conversation around affordable housing is that public housing, even Habitat for Humanity, is not addressing the needs of our families in West Guelph, and I'm assuming throughout Guelph, of our large families, our new Canadian families with 7 and 9. And so just when we're thinking about affordable housing, I think there was comment made about land prices and so on, and just the need for bigger space to respectfully accommodate the change in the demographics of our community. If you can speak a little bit to that, because we don't want to become owners of property as a community development cooperative. We want to facilitate that conversation and that model for that to happen for our families.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm not a development expert, so it may take some more digging. But, you know, I'm from a high level, development costs have just gone through the roof over the past 2 years with inflation. And now on top of that, we also have interest rates going up. And with interest rates going up, it means that borrowing to pay for those higher development costs are going up as well. So it's getting harder and harder to build units, and that's forcing the price up for these units as well. There's lots of other reasons. Developers will say things like, you know, the planning process is too long. Community advocates will say, well, developers are looking for too much profit out of these developments as well. There's probably some truth to all of that. But certainly inflation and interest rates are big challenges. The math is easier to do if you build more smaller units than if you build fewer bigger units. The bigger the unit, the less money you're making per unit. So that makes it challenging. It's easier to do the math for many one bedroom units or two bedroom units than to add some three or four bedroom units in there. There isn't, in terms of government incentives, programs that I've seen, I haven't seen any programs that incentivize the creation of larger units, recognizing that larger units cost more money than smaller units to make. So that's a challenge. Where this may be possible is thinking about land that's already in community ownership and leveraging that. So we've seen things like United Church of Canada redeveloping old church lands. You know, Indwell is doing a big push on church lands as well. That's one opportunity for bringing down the cost. These are lands already quasi-community land trust because it's owned by the charitable sector. So it's protected by the CRA. Another piece, going back to an earlier comment, is, you know, how do we think about creating respectful apartments or units for seniors who currently own single family homes? These are homes already designed for larger families. They're often in neighborhoods with schools, with parks, with backyards. These are already set up for that. And if it is cheaper to make condos or apartments without some of those same amenities that are a little bit smaller, you know, maybe that's another option as well. But making sure that these are spots that people want to move to, as opposed to just, you know, kind of pushing people out of their homes into another place as well. So these are all kind of messy overlapping pieces. And again, you know, I don't want to claim more expertise on any of these issues than I actually possess. But those are a few thoughts, and you're asking some great questions, Linda.
Okay. There was another quick question, and that is, what kind of return might investors expect, if any, if they invest in a CLT?
So generally a CLT, and this is a challenge for CLTs, is they rely on donations of cash or donations of land. And it's really slowed down the growth of CLTs. So Hamilton's Community Land Trust had a parcel of land donated to them by the city about 5 or 6 years ago. They partnered with, I believe, the YMCA that built, or possibly Habitat, that built a home on top of that donated land. And I don't believe they've acquired an additional parcel since. In Kensington Market Land Trust, the City of Toronto provided a $2 to $3 million mortgage for them to buy their first parcel. In the City of Toronto, the Parkdale Neighborhood Land Trust just received about 80 single family homes from Toronto Community Housing. So all that's still really important, and it shows the importance of city involvement. It also shows the potential to build an asset base that they can leverage in the future as they build equity on these homes, and that helps them grow. And that's a way that community land trusts often grow, is through past purchases as they build up equity. But that can take time. You do see organizations like Indwell and House of Friendship here in Wardour Region putting out bonds where they're paying 4 or 5% returns to community investors. You know, that's about where we typically see these types of social community finance pieces, is in that 3 to 5% range. And you know, what that looks like is it's cheaper than going to the bank. So we as a community are saying, you know, I'm not in a position that I can donate $10,000 to an affordable housing organization, but I can lend it to an affordable housing organization. To lower the amount of money they need to get from more expensive bank debt, and bank debt will have more restrictive covenants. A bank won't lend 100% normally of the cost of building or buying as well. So it fills that gap that is necessary. And if you think of it as replacing bank debt is often coming from these kind of big international sources of finance. Now instead, we're replacing it with cheaper, more flexible community finance. It's not the same as a donation. It's not the same as government finance. It is a stopgap. It's not a perfect solution, but it's one more tool in our community's tool chest.
Ron East wants to know, does city administration provide impediments or prevent or make it very difficult for nonprofit development?
I think it's a tough question to answer. I think there's a lot of people, speaking directly in for Guelph, I think there is a lot of people in planning and zoning that want to make a change and see this happen. I think it's a very difficult thing. I wouldn't necessarily say there's huge impediments. From a financial standpoint, I think providing some incentives to developers who are wanting to create a meaningful housing project would make a difference. More kind of from the outside in, because I wasn't on the ground floor of the planning and development of the watershed co-housing. I was only getting kind of snippets. There's fees, cash in lieu of parkland is a big one that goes towards parks and recreation. And it's a lot of money that gets taken out of the build or taken out of the time in terms of developing it properly. Like I said, I don't think there's people directly standing in front of it. I think there's just a lot of policies and fees that if they could be incentivized would make a big difference in some of these more meaningful developments. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a non-for-profit development, but it's certainly not profitable in this case. It's definitely gathered a group of like-minded people that are taking a big risk, and the developer in this case certainly will not be. This is more of a legacy project for him. It's not about money. And we need more people like David to be doing these projects. And if there could be some discretion within the city building and planning fees to encourage it, I think that would make a big difference.
One piece maybe for the community to look at is something called a Municipal Capital Facilities Agreement. And it isn't a panacea, but it provides some flexibility where the city is able to partially or fully waive development fees, to lower property taxes, to provide grants or loans, including to projects like co-housing or nonprofits. So Guelph likely, or Wellington, would have a bylaw like this that would describe how it works. And if not, it's something to look at. I know in the region, ours is quite old. So there may be an opportunity to modernize it as well. So it's not a one-off where every single time we need to go for approval, but perhaps if you fit within certain criteria. But I'm sure there are other folks at the city or with involvement who know a lot more about that stuff than I do.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any provisions in Guelph's bylaws for waiving those like development charges and such for not-for-profit or co-housing, but that's something I hope we do have. And if we don't, I hope we look into and adopt that at some point in the future. So thank you for telling us about that, Sean. And we've been going for roughly just shy of an hour and a half. So I think this would be a good place to wrap up. I just want to thank once again our two guests, Sean Campbell and Eric Small. We really appreciate your time and your contributions. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'm going to pass it over to Tanya for some closing announcements.
Please do have your say on the comprehensive zoning bylaw review. If you have questions or comments, please email zoningreview@guelph.ca. And there's also a project page on haveyoursay.guelph.ca. You can also have your say about the cycling network study. On Wednesday, July 27th at City Hall, please do come to check out the preliminary preferred design options. The doors open at 4 and the presentation and Q&A are at 6:30. And you can have your say on the Have Your Say website by August the 10th. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're talking about Emancipation Day with Queen and Denise Francis of the Guelph Black Heritage Society.
Breezy Breakfast is a weekly news and information show. The coffee is always warm and energizing, and the guests always increase our appetites for more food for thought. Thanks to the Breezy team of Kevin Bowman, Morgan Dandy, Tanya Gavard, and Phil Out. Music provided by Jules Germ. I'm Jia Yuyan, the producer of the Breezy Breakfast podcast.